early, who knows, we might even finish early. Okay, so everyone should know the plan. Tomorrow, Dennis is going to give a little module on Ginsburg Landau theory, which will start in the lecture, and then he'll have a tutorial problem applying Ginsburg Landau theory. And so that's a really, how should I say it, general purpose tool in your theoretical toolkit, important to know. Friday is the last lecture. I'm trying to design a lecture in honor of Phil Anderson, who would have given this course if he had been able to be here. So I've been reviewing Phil's most recent ideas, what he would have said to you, and I can see that it actually fits nicely into what we've done, so that should be fine. In the last lecture, I started talking about model Hamiltonians, the so-called Hubbard model. And these are Hamiltonians with the simplest possible interactions between electrons. The standard Hubbard model says that there's an extra cost or in energy if two electrons happen to be on the same site. And then the other term is just the kinetic energy that lets them hop around. And then you can also write down the so-called extended Hubbard model by putting in an extra term, which would say that if two electrons are on the same site, on neighboring sites, then there's an extra energy of interaction due to the fact that they're nearest neighbors. So for instance, an attractive nearest neighbor interaction would lead to superconductivity based on Cooper pairs that are in singlet states on neighboring sites. So that's a very simple concept. Much, much, much more profound concept is the idea that if you have a strong repulsive interaction for two electrons on the same site, okay, so if the only thing in your Hamiltonian is hopping, and a strong repulsion for two electrons on the same site, that leads to an effective exchange interaction for electron spins on neighboring sites, which is attractive in the singlet channel, in other words, anti-ferromagnetic, and could then, in principle, lead to superconductivity of singlet pairs of electrons on neighboring sites. Okay. Now, that whole concept I tried to describe yesterday is much more subtle, because basically what you're saying is that to a first approximation, electrons, you never want to have two electrons on the same site, assuming that you've got less than one electron per site. That Hamiltonian says you never want to have two electrons on the same site. But in perturbation theory, one can hop on to an occupied site as long as they're in a relative singlet state. In other words, if you like, anti-parallel spins, but really relative singlet state. It can hop on virtually and hop off, but it cannot do that if they're in a relative triplet state. In other words, if they're spins are parallel, then that's impossible. So the gain in energy that you get from second-order perturbation theory only happens in the singlet channel. And that leads to this effective anti-ferromagnetic exchange interaction between nearest neighbor spins. Okay. Now, why do I emphasize that this is such a subtle concept? The reason why it's such a subtle concept is that we're no longer talking about electrons that can move freely through the lattice, regardless of what the other ones are doing. Now, all of a sudden, it's a strongly correlated problem. They can only move where other electrons are not. Okay, and that is the difficult problem. And this theory has that built into it. So the idea, for instance, that you take your stakes and you take your Hamiltonian and you project onto the manifold where there are no doubly occupied sites is a highly non-trivial statement in many body theory and difficult to implement. The electrons can do it. They know how to do it. But for us to figure out how they do it is a difficult problem. Anyway, with that preface, then let me say that it is of interest to consider the case where there is an attractive interaction for electrons on nearest neighbor sites and treat that in the mean field theory that we use to solve the BCS superconductivity problem. Okay? So, the possibility, yeah, Akosa.
Are we considering the electrons to occupy latent sites or the atoms?
You can say that they're occupying orbitals that are labeled by lattice sites. Okay? So, for instance, the simplest thing is to imagine that there's an S orbital available on every site. And you can add electrons to so that there's roughly one electron per site. And they hop between those identical orbitals at different sites.
So where are the nucleus?
Where are they spatially? Okay, so if you move the atoms apart, so you take your lattice and make it very expanded, okay, then they would occupy that atomic orbital, which would be, you know, an angstrom or two ball. Okay? And then if you bring your atoms together, those start to overlap and hybridize. So like if you move them way apart, there's this picture that you have this infinitely degenerate system. On every atom, there's a state that has that energy. And you've got n atoms, so there are n such states all with the same energy. As you start to move them together, what solid-state physics or condensed matter tells you is that those states, because of the overlap of the wave functions, hybridize and form a band. You do the Fourier transform, you find that the energy states or the eigenstates of the crystal translation operator, and depending on the wave vector, they have higher or lower energy. Okay. So, but that's where they are. They're not, you know, a lattice site is like a point in space. They're not at a point in space. And in actual point of fact, when you talk about a real material, it's much more complicated. Like in the cuprates, you have squares of a lattice of copper ions with an oxygen in between every pair of copper ions along the x and, you know, y direction of the square. So it's got copper, oxygen, copper, oxygen. It's this nice square lattice. The orbitals that the electrons sit in is actually a hybridized combination of one of the d orbitals of the copper and some p orbitals on the oxygens, in such a way that you end up with one orbital per copper atom, okay, when you work through the quantum chemistry, as Phil Anderson did immediately upon the discovery of high-temperature superconductivity, you realize that there is one orbital per copper atom that an electron sits in, and that it's exactly like this Hubble model, where they can pop, and if you put an extra one in there, there's a big Coulomb repulsion. So these things all come out. These are very highly idealized models of the actual quantum chemistry.
Okay.
So the possibility of attractive nearest neighbor interactions leads us to consider a mean field Hamiltonian. Of the following form. that's the kinetic energy, and then put in the potential energy. That's the kind of potential term. And then, plus a pairing term. Oh, what am I doing? Sorry, don't start already.
Too many C's.
Should have taken these down here. These are okay. Too many arrows in the wrong place. Okay, let's keep going here. I'll tell you what these things mean in a second. Actually, I think this isn't quite right. Just a minute, let's do. Oh, I think maybe I cooked this up so that it works. Have to think about this for a second. So basically what I've done is I've said that there is some amplitude for creating a singlet pair on site delta. And then I'm not quite sure why I didn't do up-down pairs and then have another term with a down-up pair. except that there's a delta and a minus delta. In other words, as you know, the sum picks up every bond twice. So when it picks up the bond the other way, so we have up, down, and then when we pick up the other term, we get down, up. Yeah, okay, let's just assume that this is right. We can check it. I think it's probably right. It does actually, I believe, put a single pair on every bond. Yeah?
If you keep your sum over delta, then you don't need the sum over I, and you can include the minus, you can put the same minus delta.
That's what I was. You mean like this? That's what it is. Delta is summed over the nearest neighbor. It's I summed over all sites. Okay. So you're saying you...
If we leave just sum over delta,
yeah,
then we can move the sum over I and place minus delta and the delta speed.
Uh Well, I and I plus delta is different from I. This is I minus x over here, right? But this is I plus x. So that's a different bond. But if you increment I by 1 and then look at minus delta, then you get the same bond. Do you see what I'm saying?
There's some over delta and some over the.
Some over delta is the sum over the four neighbors, say, in a square. Sum over I is the sum over every side. Okay, so remember the convention here is I equals 1 to n, and delta equals like x minus x, y minus y, z minus z, you know, however many conventions you have. That was the convention for delta is the sum over neighbors of a particular site. Okay, so let's assume that I've got this right. Then we can Fourier transform this, and square lattice. And that's particularly with the high TC hoop rates in mind. And then what we get is a normal kinetic energy. Okay, so it's putting in the Fourier transform. And then this thing here we'll call delta of k. And this then is delta of k stuff. And so far there's nothing new. Epsilon of k is minus 2t cos kx plus cos ky, and delta of k is equal to delta x e to the I kx minus I kx, I guess, with this convention, plus delta y e to the minus I ky plus delta minus x e to the I kx plus delta minus y e to the I ky. Now remember that we use this Hamiltonian as a variational Hamiltonian in doing Hartree-Fock on the interacting electron system. And so in the end, the parameters in this Hamiltonian will be chosen to minimize the free energy. So the question is what will we get for delta x, delta y, delta minus x, and delta minus y? And there's various possibilities. So one possibility Which, well, we'll consider two possibilities. So, so one possibility is delta x equals delta minus x equals delta y equals delta minus y. And then, just to make our life easy, let's say that they're all real. And if that were the case, then would then what we'll call delta s of k would equal 2 delta times cos kx plus cos ky. So in other words, the k dependence of the gap would just be exactly like the k dependence of the kinetic energy, because you add x minus e to the ikx, e to the minus ikx all together. And so that says that you'd have a gap like this, which, if you like, has the symmetry of the Brillouin zone, of the square Brillouin zone. It has the same sign as you go around the Fermi surface. So Kf will be given by this equal mu, and this will be constant on the Fermi surface. This will be constant on the Fermi surface. Okay, so you'll just have a gap, which is the same everywhere on the Fermi surface. Okay, and that's exactly the same type of gap or symmetry of gap that you get in an S-wave superconductor. In an S-wave superconductor, the Fermi surface is a circle or a sphere, and the gap is the same everywhere. And for this is like the lattice version of that. Okay. That's why it's called S for S-wave. This is actually called extended S-wave. A much more interesting possibility is when delta y equals delta minus y equals minus delta x. And for the sake of simplicity, we'll say that they're real. In that case, oh, I see, this is called 2 delta s. Why did I say that? 2 delta s is random. I don't know. In that case, what we'll call delta d of k is equal to 2 delta times 2 cos kx minus 2 cos ky. It's called d wave. So this has the property that if k is along plus or minus x, it's positive. If k is along plus or minus y, it's negative, depending on the actual value of k. The point is that it changes sign as you go across the line kx equals ky. It has the symmetry of a d wave function. Yeah.
Why there is another 2 in bracket?
Good question. Mm-hmm. So in either case, the quasi-particle excitation energies But for delta D of K, so we have this picture of the Brillouin zone, where if this is kf over root 2, and this is also there are these 4 points on the Fermi surface. So what does the Fermi surface look like here? It probably, let's see. I think it probably looks like for a less than half filled band. I hope I got that right. Looked all right. Okay. So pi would be out here. So the point is that there are these four nodal points. And you can look at the excitation energies around these 4 points. So let me just make sure that this is absolutely obvious to everyone. At the Fermi energy, this vanishes, because E is U. At the Fermi point, at those four nodal points, the gap also vanishes. So everything vanishes in the excitation energy at these 4 points. So what does the excitation spectrum look like? So let's look near the four nodal points. So near the nodes, K is equal to KF, the vector, plus K parallel, plus K perpendicular, where K parallel is a small vector along the Fermi wave vector, and K perpendicular is a small vector perpendicular to KF, tangent to the Fermi surface. So KF, as I've said, is equal to the magnitude of KF times 1 over root 2, 1 over root 2. K parallel is equal to, same thing. Let's call it K1 times 1 over root 2, 1 over root 2. And K perpendicular is equal to K2 times minus 1 over root 2, 1 over root 2. So that's what those things look like. And if you put that into the dispersion relation, delta of K is equal to 2 delta times this is post case sum of these three things, and this is cos ky sum of these three things. And you can expand this out for small distances from the node. And I guess the way I like to expand it is just to use the so this is, write this as cos minus sine sine. So you have cos af over root 2, cos k1 minus k2 over root 2 minus, so this is the first term, and then the second term, this guy, is cos kf over root 2, cos k1 plus k2 over root 2, plus sine, sine kf over root 2 times sine K1 plus K2 over root 2. Where K1 and K2 are assumed to be small. So this is just 1. This is basically K1 minus K2 over root 2. These are sine KX. And the cosines cancel. And so this turns out to be equal to approximately 4 delta . So why sine of why k2? Because when you expand the sine here, you get plus k2 when you expand the, when you expand the sine here, you get plus k2 and plus k2, but when here you get minus k1 plus k1, which cancels, and so you get, just get k2. And then, I'm not going to work through the algebra, but an exactly similar calculation gives epsilon of k minus mu equals minus 4t Now here, the fact that the first cosine terms cancel is because it's e minus mu. Mu is actually equal to ef, so that part cancels off. Now we could write this as if we define vf, the velocity of the Fermi energy, as 2 root t sine kf over root 2. That's just the derivative of the energy with respect to k out along the Fermi energy. And if we have that definition, then this So in other words, if we write the sine kf as in terms of vf over t, then basically this factor here is down, is vf down by a factor of delta over 2. Remember, the gap is assumed small compared to the electron kinetic energy Hawking term. And then the quasi-particle excitation spectrum looks like this. Now, we derive this solution for this nodal point. But clearly you can do exactly the same solution around each of these four nodal points and define a K1 and a K2 as being radial along KF or transverse or tangent to the Fermi energy. And since everything gets squared anyway, the signs don't matter. And so this is near any of the four nodes. Okay? So you have this kind of relativistic dispersion relation, except it's clearly anisotropic. The direction, the slope, the way that the gap opens up in this direction is much more slowly than the way that it opens up in this direction. Okay, because vf will be much larger than V1 by a factor of delta over T. So it's anisotropic. When you go and calculate everything, you end up rescaling and you know, making it isotropic, and the factors of V1 over VF go outside the integral. but the bottom line is that you have this excitation spectrum, and if you then look at the entire spectrum, what you find is that there's a density of states if this is, say, delta, and we're plotting density of states versus energy, then the density of states versus energy for the excitations starts off linearly and then goes down, roughly on the scale of delta. For low temperature physics properties, what's important is this. And that's very different from the, I guess I never drew the density of states for the S-wave BCS case. So let me do that now, okay? So the density of states, if you have a normal metal with an isotropic gap and the density of states is roughly constant in the normal state, then the presence of the superconducting gap basically pushes states up to delta and down to minus delta in such a way, let me just draw it in a separate graph. No, I think this is right. It's a delta. So it looks like this. There's a big square root singularity as states get pushed up above the gap, and then it falls off. So you can see right away that thermodynamically these two cases are going to be very different. The low temperature behavior of a system with this type of gap is going to be exponential at low temperatures. Everything will be exponential at low temperatures. The effects of excitations will disappear exponentially as T goes to zero with the scale of the gap. And the difference here consequences of the nodes. Is power law temperature dependencies. Okay. Now, for instance, remember the superfluid density NS of T, the density of superelectrons that can flow in a supercurrent and screen the magnetic field or carry current. It's related to the London penetration depth, 1/λ². For S wave, I think it's the 2 delta times, do you remember? I think it's, no, actually it's probably delta. I think I just took this out of some notes. So I'll just check. It's within a factor of 2, it's even minus delta over 2. So what does that mean? What that means is that the superfluid density grows up at TC. And then becomes exceedingly flat. And in fact, I guess in the Ginsburg-Landau theory or this Gordon-Casimir relation, it had it going like 1 minus something times t to the fourth. But t to the fourth wasn't really t to the fourth. T to the fourth just has this property that it's a very flat function when t is small. In actual point of fact, thermodynamically, the thing is exponentially going flat. So the difference between S wave and D wave goes like a constant times the temperature. So basically, it looks like this. That's a huge difference. And yet it took, if my memory is a little bad, 8691, yeah, it probably took 5 years before people could distinguish between this and this. Okay? So in the early days of high temperature superconductivity, it was assumed that high temperature superconductivity was S wave, conventional, except with a greatly increased scale, energy scale, that your gaps were 100 Kelvin instead of 10 Kelvin or 1 Kelvin. Okay? And that belief was allowed to persist because experiments were very difficult, to put it that way. In particular, it was hard to make single crystals, so you had powders, and the superfluid was just going in between grains from one grain to another. You weren't measuring the superfluid density. The first measurements of this linear temperature dependence of the superfluid density were done actually at UBC by the group of Walter Hardy and Doug Vaughan, and Xing Liang, who grew the beautiful crystals. And those were microwave measurements of the superfluid density. Incredibly striking linear behavior. You would never, ever, once having looked at that data, doubt it and understood the experimental technique, which many people found difficult to do. You would never have doubted that it was linear temperature dependence. Okay? So that was the first. Okay, that was the first conclusive evidence for D-wave superconductivity in the high TC superconductors. The important thing to remember is the very high scale for these high temperature superconductors. The energy gap tends to be one and three quarters, in BCS theory, it's about 1¾ times TC. TC for these materials was between 40 and 100 Kelvin. And the energy gap was 1¾ times that, at least BCS theory. And so it's easy to do experiments below 10 Kelvin. And so there's no problem, once you have good samples, single crystal samples, getting into the regime where all these power laws appear. It also, in the specific heat, the electronic specific heat, goes like t squared, and 1 over t1 goes like t cubed, and so forth. So having a D-wave superconductor makes an enormous difference. Okay.
It's a good thing to explain what 1 over T1 is.
Oh, sorry. David Corden. Okay, sorry. What's 1 over T1? Okay. So in nuclear magnetic resonance, you basically cause transitions between nuclear spin states, or equivalently, you create a coherent motion of the spins, which is a non-equilibrium situation, which can then relax back to the thermodynamic equilibrium situation, which is no coherent magnetization. Okay, so T1, and this is an extremely generic definition, is the time if you take a system and change it from equilibrium. T1 is the time that it takes it to relax back to the thermal equilibrium state. Okay? And that time can be anything because it depends on how the system that you're manipulating connects to the thermal bath. So for instance, in the case of nuclear spins, in a nuclear magnetic resonance measurement in a superconductor, in a normal metal, okay? In a normal metal, if you polarize the nuclear spins and maybe get them going around the magnetic field, and the question is how do they get back to thermal equilibrium, there's lots of little excitations where you flip a nuclear spin and you create a particle hole pair. And remember, in the Fermi liquid, you can do that at infinitesimal energy. And so there's plenty of ways for the nuclear spins to relax to the temperature of the bath, which in that case is the conduction electrons of the metal. Now all of a sudden, it goes superconducting. Okay? Well, when you go superconducting, you open up a gap. And now all of a sudden, you can't flip a nuclear spin and absorb an infinitesimal amount of energy because there's this big gap, which is the minimum amount of energy that you can absorb. Now, I should qualify that by saying that remarkably, in the case of conventional superconductors, as you cool through TC, the first thing that happens is not that the spin relaxation rate goes down, it's actually that it goes up. Okay? And why that happens is, if you like, encoded in the BCS wave function. It has to do with the coherence of the BCS wave function, the U's and the V's, which allows the excitations just below TC, where remember the gap is still very small and the temperature is high, it allows them to relax nuclear spins more effectively, and you get something called the Hebel-Schlichter peak. But nevertheless, as you go down further in temperature, so the gap is starting to be fully developed, then you can no longer relax those spins, and the nuclear relaxation rate goes to zero exponentially. If you like, T1, that time goes to infinity. Okay? So the difference then in a D-wave superconductor is the rate only vanishes much more slowly, like T cubed. Interesting question, how do you do NMR inside a superconductor? Because you need to have that magnetic field that the spins are precessing around. So it's a good trick, actually. And I guess Charlie Schlichter at the University of Illinois is one of the pioneers of this technique, where you at some high field, you create a nuclear magnetization, pulse it, get it going, you turn off your field, it's precessing around, and then you wait a little while, and then you come back in and look at it again. with the fields and see how much it's relaxed. Okay, so it's a complicated business anymore, but it's the interesting thing that I would like to say about NMR, which I'm not saying anything further about, is that understanding nuclear magnetic resonance, say pulse nuclear magnetic resonance, is actually the key to a whole menagerie of physical systems. Because basically, the pulsed NMR problem is the time dependence of the two-level system problem in equilibrium with both a thermal bath and with other things that can cause decoherence. And so it's the general two-level system problem. And then in addition to that, there are many other systems that can be simply modeled as a collection of two-level systems. And so it actually is a key to a broad range of physics problems. Okay, so that's it for today. And tomorrow's Dennis, and Friday's the last lecture.